Epilogue, take two. The fireman told himself a lot more garbage of this nature. Then he told himself some true things. Donald Barthelme. Okay, wait a minute. The child-free analogy is a true thing, sure, at its root. Not garbage, I wouldn't go that far, no. Just that it could easily end up there if I'm not careful, throwing those big words together and around that way, leaving them like that, both too much, all that life and death angst drama, and too little, easy to underestimate, keep at bay, just another cutesy kitty LOL internet meme, something the townspeople wouldn't even need to grumble about, so squishy sweet, or the powers that be wouldn't have to worry about. A neat figure of speech, but no threat, even to the quotidian status quo, let alone the social order. Something maybe epideictic, to borrow an Aristotelian term I have never, I hope, once used in my public writing. So all day yesterday, I had a nagging sense that there was something else, had to be, something more, something missing there, the teeth. I just couldn't put a finger on it, or a word to it. Since I'm the only body in my bed now, no one there to calibrate my clock in collaboration with, I often sleep erratically, out of kilter, off tempo. I get all the sleep I need, but it's often in disconnected increments. Sometimes I wake up wide awake in the middle of the night, or just way too early, like I did last night, the last filaments of a dream receding forever into oblivion, leaving only a faint trace of what it meant. I knew the dream I had lost all the details of had something to do with who Free was and what I needed to say about him. One thing the residue of my dream made clear was this. Free was not me, at least not the whole of me, the one you might think I am all the time if all you know about me is this book, the impression I might have left you with yesterday. Whitman says it best. I am vast. I contain multitudes. So do you. So do we all. Myriads of me's. Our culture, our lives may compel us to think and act most often as if we are only one of them. I, the necessary one, the normal one, the one induced from the outside in by whatever we need to be to survive our public lives, with all of those opportunities and obligations and problems pouring in toward us. But what about the rest of the multitudes? Where do they get to be in the equation that we keep trying to balance in there? I was asking my class the other day, as I always do whenever I'm teaching anything that makes the question pertinent, whether or not they believe anyone else can truly know them the way they know themselves. This particular occasion for the question was prompted by Susan Griffin's claim in Our Secret that she wants to get inside Heinrich Himmler's head, via the arsenal of biographic and fictional tools she has at her disposal. I am always surprised, stunned really, by how many of them, usually more than half, think that's possible, easy even. I certainly don't. I feel that if someone trying to write my biography could get access to everything I've written or made, to everyone who knew me, they would still get it wrong. And I am one of the most self-revelatory scholars in the academic universe. I will and have disclosed just about anything you can think of about myself along the way. In my books and poems especially, as you now know just from having read this one, the most intimate, confidential things in my head, my heart, no inhibitions at all, it sometimes seems, all out there for all to see. That's one of the reasons I'm always amused when others describe me as private. I am, in my writing especially, the least private person I know, with no apparent barriers to self-disclosure. As I often think, private? Hello, have you read the book? I am, on the other hand, reclusive, as I made clear along the way. And that covers all the parts almost no one ever gets to see, hear, know, except maybe for Emily Dickinson, or Carol, or some other nobody too, who actually asks me, "Who are you?" I'm not really trying to hide any of that. It's just that you have to be with somebody doing something, walking, laughing, crying together, side by side, eye to eye, for it to show. Then the words that come, well, they come alive, embodied, made flesh, right there, in the woods, over coffee, in my office, me and you, alive, together. Writing? Just words, all alone there on the page? No, they won't do it. If that distinction, private, reclusive, doesn't make sense to you, well, think about it. Or reread what I said about Emily Dickinson. One day, it will. That's one of the me's, then, that never takes on a public face. And there are tons of other me's, too, I never say anything about, just like you don't, for good reasons. For example, you never have to endure the me that cleans the toilets, eats ice cream at night, stares vacantly at the TV as if it is just a window facing a blank wall. That man is boring. Functional, but so boring. Carol could have told you that. So boring. He knows Free, lives in the same head with him, likes him quite a lot, actually. But he isn't him. Nor do you get to measure my deepest grief, my greatest rage, neither of which ever finds, or even could find, a way into words. That man is intense, dramatic, scary maybe, the one everyone fears might show up if they ask the me in front of them about my loss. Though, of course, he never would or could for lack of those words. I can't believe they don't know that. He knows Free, too, same way, good buddies. But he isn't him. None of those me's and most of the multitudes of others striving to collaborate in there, to get along, appear unitary in public, for decorum's sake, is Free. Who then is he? And what do I need most to say now to qualify or add to what I said yesterday? Here's what my dream told me to say, even though I couldn't remember the details of it. Free is not even the me you see when you read this book. He is the me I get to be with, near, while I'm in there. In some figurative way, he is the book itself. Yes, I thought, of course, exactly, obviously, so obvious I couldn't believe it took me 6 months and a forgotten dream to see it. What's the first thing my book says when it walks up to you, shakes your hand in those wacky opening fake review blurbs? I am Free. Just like Free, who came to me in that dream the very week I both marked the anniversary of Carol's passing and finished my book. As soon as I thought that, I started laughing. A laugh that came on with one of those side-of-the-mouth pop-by-yuck-yucks and culminated in a couple of guffaws. Letting loose like that in bed in the middle of the night is one of the very few perks that comes with sleeping alone. No one there to wake up wondering what has taken possession of her partner. Since I had woken up so early, about 5:30, I had to wait to take my walk, left right at first light. The woods are beautiful, so soothing in that kind of light. About a quarter of a mile up the path, on the walk I take most days, there is a fulsome space, a grand space, where the trees are farther apart and quite large. It's the space I mentioned in Entry 8, when I was brought to tears by my recognition of their obvious, ongoing love for me, so steady, so always there, each one, and all together. Every time I enter that space, I feel a sense of solemnity, not in its Eliotic too highness, but in its diurnal just rightness, a deep awareness, very placid, of the weight of those trees, spiritually, their dignity, their care. I try to remind myself to carry an awareness of that weight in my bearing all that day long, like they do. I'm not that good, of course, that steady. But I keep thinking that if I try to do it enough times in recognition of their gift to me. I will get better at it. Lately, and especially today, I've been contemplating the physical structure of the space in that place. All those tall, columnar trees reaching up until they evaporate into the dense ceiling of leaves above, so midsummer lush now. I believe that is exactly what we humans keep striving to emulate in our most sacred spaces. All those columns reaching up, the safe closure overhead. Egyptian, Greek, European, Asian, Arabic, the monuments, churches, synagogues, mosques, temples, shrines, all of them, trying to prompt us to feel, when we walk into them, the solemnity that such spots in the woods have always made us feel, humanly, deeply. I was watching a show on the Parthenon recently in which experts claim that the column was what it was primarily for engineering-related reasons. Just the best way to hold up a big high roof, at least until the arch came along. But I think it's the other way around. Someone starts wondering how they can make a space that emulates the one I walk through every day, the one that makes me feel both larger than life and more fully human, small, in all the right ways. The available materials, stone and wood, make it necessary for them to regularize everything, same height, right angles, or round contours, a replicable sameness. The woods doesn't have to abide by those constraints. It is free, and it doesn't cost anything to build itself. That is free, too. I'm sure those architects designing their buildings lamented the fact that they, too, could not be that free. Not at least if what they built was going to stand up and last. We're not free either, at least not most of the time. We have to clean toilets, want to eat ice cream, crave blank-faced distraction. We rage and despair. Free, as I said, is not those me's. He is the one I get to be with, near, walking through the solemn space those trees make for me, and the one I could carry in my bearing as long into and as often during the day as I'm able. And when that me is with me, he, I, we feel fully and forever free. That, in the end, is the difference to me between man-made sacred spaces, of which I have seen and loved many, and the woods. In one, solemnity is the end of it, or maybe, if you have the faith going in, a gateway to some gods out of this world. In the other, it is a gateway straight to free, in this world, right now. Okay, that's at least part of what I needed to figure out and add to get past the nagging in my head yesterday about free and me. There is, though, another layer down I know, and I'm having a hard time trying to get a grip on it. It pertains to that bullet and asylum business outside of town there. So over the top, wow. It's possible, I guess, that free is dangerous enough to warrant such extreme measures. Maybe. But I'm surely not. I am, at best, a poet. And even that might be a stretch. A poet, that cultural figure who, sure, from time to time or place to place, can end up with a bullet to the head. Think certain parts of Central or South America in the 1970s during the heyday of military juntas, for example. Or in an asylum. Think Russia or Eastern Europe during the pre-war and Cold War years. But the United States is not one of them. Our poets are just not perceived to be very serious threats to the social order, no matter what they say. Amiri Baraka can read a poem that says, "Kill Whitey," to a white audience that then applauds him. That's how unscary poets are for us. Why? I think it's because there are an arsenal of figurative bullets and asylums that do all the work for the powers that be quietly, antiseptically, and way ahead of time. Figurative bullets? Well, remember what it was like to read poems in school? All those tiny 19th century poets, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Shelley, Whitman, Dickinson, Crane, being called one by one out of the thick books to stand in the middle of little desks imploring the teacher, "Please, shoot me now, before we're all bored to tears here." Then the teacher says, "Excuse me for a moment. I need to reload before we start the 20th century." No wonder no one listens to them, cares what they say. They never made it out of those rooms alive. And then so many of those of us who somehow smuggled a few of them out under our shirts, maybe with the help of an unarmed teacher, well, we write about them inside closed systems for one another, our prose unreadable to anyone not in on the code. We carry loaded guns, too, and we know how to use them. Don't get me wrong, I'm one of them. I get paid to do that, too. I just lament it more than most. I sometimes think that if the powers that be made it illegal for any of us to teach poetry, poets would come back to life again. They may not warrant real bullets then, but at least they'd be a little scary, enough to have the powers that be ask the cops to bring them in for a few questions. And figurative asylums? How about all of those discourses of abnormality I ranted about at the end of one of my classes last fall? Bipolar, schizophrenic, even homosexual at certain times and in certain places. Yes, they will do. Neat little verbal cells to keep some true things cordoned off over there. Exotic creatures behind bars that we can visit anytime we like, admire, enjoy, without having to take any of the wild home with us. Or even littler words, recluse, offbeat, oddball, eccentric. They do some work for the powers that be, too. And how about the other end of the spectrum? Those seemingly honorific terms, prophet, sage, visionary, mystic, genius. Well, they're not so bad either, stringing up ropes around the museum exhibits so we don't stray too far into those sacred spaces, can get back home unscathed. To be honest, I don't think the me you see here or any of my me's warrants even that sort of circumscription. No need to weave a circle round me thrice, that is. My dreams are small, so small. Tiny, because I've showed you some of them. Not dangerous at all. So what's left then from what I said yesterday? Well, I guess it's the child over there on the other side of the analogy from Free, smiling back at him and out at me. Yes, I do like that child. Children are rarely scary, of course. That's what's great about encountering one or remembering our own inner one. Yet they have enormous power to instigate change, real change, the kind the powers that be fear because they have no good way to forestall it. Bullets and asylums just don't apply to the child. Not at least if you want to stay powers that be for a while. I had a hard July this year, in my body first, but then in my head, which is more crucial to me now. It was reality again, right there, when the next layer down of it starts to work its way up through what you were certain was already rock bottom, becoming faintly visible, not frightening solely in itself, but more by what it hints toward, that there are likely many more such layers deeper and deeper down waiting for you to wear through to them, and you know you will. Scary. Sobering. What to do now? It was one of those moments where your spirit better stiffen, or it's going to give way. That's where my child comes in. I might buy Wordsworth, "Child is the father of the man" business, though I'd be much more inclined to say mother, given the differences between what and how each of these figures delivers to the process. But not the rest of his system. He says in his famous ode that we come into this world trailing clouds of glory. No, we don't. No way, I say. What we come in with is an instinct, not a need, but a desire to love and be loved. And with an instinct to resist the petty injustices that adults inflict on children, because they can. Those precursors to the horrors they inflict on one another out there in the torrents of history. Our culture has such sappy ways of talking about love. Just another cutesy kitty LOL meme most of the time. Love is hard, both to do and to keep doing, out there in reality, a July like mine was. Most of us, not all but most, have some experience with loving and being loved as children. Real love, I mean, copious for some, a sleek yacht to speed us over rough waters. Maybe just a few shreds for others, bits of flotsam we can cling to when stormy waters churn. But in both cases, love, nonetheless. It is so important, foundationally, for a good life, a life that strives toward the good, to keep a memory of that love alive. That's why we need to remember it, and why, when we can, instill it in children. Make sure they feel it, so they will remember it, too. That's one of the things that Free knows and does. That's what scared the powers that be. Not him, those children who might be listening to him. The powers that be can't afford, literally, to let that kind of love get too much out of hand. But the cutesy kitty LOL kind, no problem. You can see why. And I want to argue, even those who never felt or can't remember anything of that sort, well, we have rage, the potentially generative rage that can turn us away from trying to repeat that cycle and toward trying to break it. For example, nothing, and I mean nothing, is more powerful in my motivation to be a good teacher than all the memories of the bad teaching I endured along the way. I took umbrage at it back then, every time, burning with a belief that even I, who had no tools, no natural gifts, none for public performance, could and would do better than that someday. I was lucky, on the other hand, to be loved. But even if I hadn't been, I hope I would use my rage in that area exactly the same way I do in the classroom. Okay, Paul, pony up. Do it better right now, or shut the hell up. So July, my July. Finally, the end is in sight. This summer, my sabbatical. This fall, all of it, the end in sight, I promise. It's almost next fall, for God's sakes, Paul, so shut the hell up already. Reality can be such a frightful place. It will beat us down and then kick us while we're down. I was about to start my next sentence with we, but I stopped. Did way too much of that in my first take epilogue, which made me have to write this one. And I'm still doing it. I don't want to have to write another one. So I just stopped and set you free right then, pre-sentence, to make your own way forward. I'm just going to say I now, because I can't speak for you any longer. Probably never should have. And I don't want to lecture here again. Always my fallback rhetorical posture. I'm a professor, after all. It's what I know how to do, unfortunately. You are an adult just like me. You know everything I know already and will make your choices accordingly. So let me restart that sentence. I need to stand up again now, no matter how hard it is, no matter how tired I am of doing it. Not to prove I can take it. I've done that. But to show, I mean really show, that I can make it. Not to them, all those townspeople clapping distractedly while I walk out of town, or the powers that be waiting, or even you, but to me. You don't need to read my book. I do. And I will. Over and over, trying to let Free teach all these other me's what we need to keep remembering. Read and reread it again and again cry and laugh, cry and laugh. Every time I get knocked down, I need to stand up again and again. Every single time. I'm just about at the end of the street now, I see. The crowd has thinned. What little applause is left is light, intermittent. The children have gone off to play. The edge of the woods is right up ahead there. I can hear the powers that be chatting, still hidden in the shade as they always are, no matter how hard I might try to dream them into sight. I can't make out what they are saying and don't even care. They will do what they will with me when I get there, in their woods, their rules. All I can say is this. Tomorrow morning, just after I finish my coffee, or whenever I feel like it, I'll be heading out to my woods, where I'll walk for an hour or so, on my little path, for the more than many thousandth time, acting like I'm seeing it for the first time, amazed, looking maybe like I'm alone there, but really, with all those trees, the ones that truly love me, with Carol, who truly love me, my kids, who truly love me, all always in my heart. Such goodly company. Maybe even with you for a while, or from time to time, if you don't mind talking haphazardly about whatever comes to mind, or just being quiet for a while, together with me. The garbage of this nature world has an endless supply of bullets and asylums. I know a guy who knows some true things. That's where I'll be if you're looking for me, in Boyce Park, with him, just walking, free as a bird, all for free.